Blog Talk Radio.
To Masonic Effects. It's a pleasure to have you here. If we were sitting down and through a chance meeting began to had the occasion to sit and relax a little bit, maybe between rushing to the train station or an airport or between meetings, or maybe we're at a conference, or maybe it's our day off and we're just walking. I found this convenient cafe and grabbed the morning paper. Whatever the reason we sit down together, what would we begin to talk about? Well, depending on where we are, there might be a period of standoffish, not quite sure whether we have the temperament or whether we're intruding, but let's say we went past all of that. What would we talk about? What would be the common points? Here where I am, we immediately talk about the icebreaker's weather. We immediately do, and we can go on a great length about that. Especially today, weather and climate, and it all begins to fit, doesn't it? It all has a place. But in the day, what would we talk about? Politics? How are the kids? Do you have a family? Quality of education, maybe? Maybe not as an icebreaker. We might just be feeling each other out a bit, too. Are we similar-minded in our political structure? Are we, do we have some, do we share some curiosity? And do we read? Do we, any good news? That kind of thing. Of course. And then we get a sense of the person. It's like getting a sense of a person by asking what they read. Or what drives their curiosity, or how do they deal with just the general sense of what's going on around them? Do they push it back and ignore it? Is it all too overwhelming, or is that such a stupid question to ask? Or why would I even? Nevertheless, it struck me as curious with that the earliest extant records that we have about our kind sitting down and meeting minutes come from the very, very late 14th century, 1398, I believe it was, and I don't recall the lodge that the names involved. But it struck me that it was about that period. Isn't that the period when the Renaissance was, breaking out? No, it was, yes, there was the Renaissance, and I wondered if there was any possible connection. So if you'll indulge me a little bit today, I would appreciate it. And I'm going to try and be reasonably complimentary of us and a bit descriptive. The men of the day speak about topical matters. Matters that are relevant, and I do look at the landscape around me and think that it can be more challenging than previously. But what basis of comparison, you would ask? What consistency are we using? Am I using to measure, to compare? Just a general sense, that we went through between that period and now, that time and now, our history has been surprising. And yet we can look back, our historians will help us with the details, who are correcting imperfections in our storytelling, inaccuracies, let's say. It's like the space telescopes. Things from a far distance are becoming clearer and clearer as the work progresses, as the work continues. And it's really quite remarkable that in a way that we can harvest all of this. The next generation behind us will have that much more of an advantage. Now, do I get to sigh and think, my goodness, it used to be so simple? Well, yeah, that's sort of an oversimplified notion, isn't it? Compared to what? Compared to what? It used to be that there was a settling that we couldn't, you know, we just settled. That was life the way it was, in our memories especially, and our recount, our recall will tend to embellish the positives. So if we're looking for accuracy, you don't want to rely on memory. My goodness, we have so many emotional filters going on and perspectives. And that little quirk in the brain that we've talked about here, spoken about on the program, about how the brain, what do we call it? Let's call it elasticity here, that is able to fill in the story and make it consistent with patterns in our minds. And find that way we find consistencies. We seem to have found a way to sort out all of these random bits of information. And now I don't know if I'm laughing as much anymore about simulation theory. These are boyhood meanderings of the mind, or a result of idleness, that, or emerging awareness or understanding that this could be an illusion. And now, I don't know if it's an interesting stretch. May not like the result of blending certain colors together. But if you've not done it, you'll never know. Just try it and see. And then if you put those colors together, one day you might need that color. So a similar kind of thought occurred to me when I was sitting back and comparing or associating that the 14th century was a period that was when certain ideas were percolating and men were talking about them. Mankind was talking, intelligent people were talking about them. And out of that came something very, very local. The reasonable men of the day, or perhaps they weren't so reasonable, but I like to think they were, the curious types, with a bit of enthusiasm, could put we're comfortable putting questions to one another. Now, I'm not going to claim that our sense of religiosity or poetry or the studies in general are near today what they were then. I don't know. I know that Oxford, and I believe by that time, Cambridge would be on the go. So we were producing, and we had a sense of higher education, the benefits of that transference of information, the stimulation of idea. And should it be then much of a surprise, would it be a bit smug here, I guess, that Renaissance, when we look back, that open-mindedness, we'll blame the Italians. You know, it's the Italian Renaissance after. Let's just blame. Could not possibly be. And yet, if we derive any sense of benefit from those ideas, then we should perhaps think that there was something quite beneficial, but also a cost. And we can just declare with all the boyish ruthlessness we can muster that any cost would be worth it. But what was that cost? I don't know. I thought it was in my own liberal mind or conservative mind, I'll simply say whatever the cost was, it was certainly worth every bit. I don't know that. I think that's beyond my capability. Today we have around us a lot of things happening. The information about a tremendous amount of information. What do we do to select? If you were to sit down with me today in that pub and say, what are you reading? What are your ideas? Where do your thoughts drift when you're reading through a chapter of the Proverbs? I guess I would think, at what level are you? The one that's curated for me, where my attention is somehow cleansed of all of the clutter, that there's an algorithm, a mathematical algorithm, imagine that, that's going to determine what gains my attention and for how long. And somehow that's going to be an improvement. Allegedly, this is some kind of an improvement over what I would do all by myself. Is that the level of awareness? Is it when I'm not annoyed by the such thoughts, but curious about them? I sit with a communication pouring into my home constantly at so many levels now, and I have the illusion. I can control. I can pick my topics, but then I have these doubts. The doubts are like looking at the appeasement of the masses, you know, just pulp and nonsense, and calling it entertaining, repetitious, really, and wondering what the world would be like if that same kind of tool of communication that has been welcomed into most homes in the world were put to use to enlighten and educate. If the goal was enlightenment and education, who would make those decisions and how would we go about it? Right? And I think, bureaucracy. That's bureaucratic thinking, isn't it? I mean, I said, I'm a good bureaucrat. Implications, yeah, and who, and structure, your automatic thing takes you to the structure. But let's put it back in the basin and rinse the idea off and just look at it in its simplicity. We would decide. and we would decide by whether we attend to certain ideas or not. Oh, to be as fluent in French and German as I am in English, because the material, the documentaries that are being produced are just so unique, different perspectives. And through those different perspectives, we gain a composite idea, more complete. But look at the Choros, the Greek ideal form. I can look at it from one perspective, but does that do it justice? You know, as you walk around and look, and now I can have a camera work that, well, I may not be able to get to that close. There are camera perspectives that allow me to see from a close-up of the surface of the marble. And as the camera swings around, the light catching and accentuating the curvature, I can see proportion from different angles. And as I walk around, I can see a completeness of form. I can see the care taken to with the curl of hair on the neck, or the glance, or the smile. I can walk through the Louvre and have a narrator speaking in my language. I can walk through the Hermitage. It's a trigger these days, unfortunately. I can walk through the Museum of Modern Art, the Tate Modern, and savor it all. Now, for somebody to say, is it the same as being there? Well, of course not. Is it worse? Well, no, you can't say that either. So if you're asking me what grabs my attention these days, plenty. And yet, if I were to ask you, what has this done to our curiosity? Really, not whether we're happy or we're pleased with the direction of AI, and are we always aware of whether there's an ideology lurking in the background between the lines? Well, I don't know. But it's an interesting question. And I like to think that I have an anchor point in my life, like you do, through the craft. And is it simple? Hell no. It's fraught, my goodness. At some point you get over why. And then I get in the same instance, I get to revisit the whole question again. Why today? Why now? Because the landscape, I guess, tastes, including mine, are changing, ever changing. And I don't think it's stopped. And then I can sit back like you do, and we can reflect on the values that are at play in the kind of a lifestyle that we chose to live. And then I don't know if that's a sense of entitlement anymore, but I do know that I see that as a rarity. Not as many people are privileged to be able to choose, particularly when there's struggle going on. what's happening in Ukraine is a reminder. We're never really that far away from the chaos. There's always something lurking, some risk or some danger lurking. And we can't really run away from it, but we can try and arrest it. We can try and best we can is to create communities that are predictable, and safety is a good part of that. And we've done it well enough that our lives are extending. We're living longer. The primary reason we're living longer doesn't really excite people, you know, cleanliness, public health, those types of things. We want something really sexy. It's my Mediterranean diet or my vegan diet or paleo diet. Generally, it's all of that. And I guess you could say I'm pursuing a better life. If I can shave that, if I have the sense that putting in all those miles and jogging around is going to somehow give me a better life, then it is. Well, I know being limber and being out and just and doing something, you know, having that headspace and concentrating and getting in, you know, when you're putting in the kilometers and all of a sudden you're just cruising along and you're riding on it and all the endorphins and the adrenaline. You're just floating. You're in motion. Different states of awareness, eh? I'm lucky. I can strap on my selected footwear and my clothes appropriate for whatever climate I happen to be in. I can hydrate because I know about hydration. I can use the salves to help avoid the chafing. I can follow my plan, my training plan to build myself up to do marathon. And then off I go. But I don't think, if I listen to in the words of an acquaintance, medical specialist, I was an acquaintance and we had a good friend mutually. I could do it, but it's not statistically going to make a big difference. So do I have the magic to longevity? No, neither do you. But do I have the magic to happiness? Well, if I have those choices to make, yeah, by all means. By all means. And not to be smug about it, because not everybody shares that opportunity, that access. You and I are part of all of that history, and we're part of the process of making decisions between better and best. Best and worst, you make those decisions because it's fun. What's better? It's fun to do that. It's pleasurable. And you do that enough, and enough people do it, and we see the benefits. We see entire communities developing and impacting on culture. We learn to coincide. We learn to change our ways for certain benefits. We learn that we can do that, that compromise is not necessarily giving away anything unless we see it that way. If you and I determine that any compromise is giving away, cultural value, then we have reason to not do it. But does that change the big scope of things? Does that change the fates? Let's hope. If that changes the fates, then this entire program changes the fates. We'll put a pin in that. I want to just enjoy some solace, some music, And a good program today, the poetry of Alfred Lord Tennyson.
Yeah.
And music that is so, so sweet. And listeners out there from around the world, Netherlands, how are you? You're staying safe. And Germany, it's a stepping up. Yeah. Looks like the whole world is having to step up again and dust off our ethics. Good on us. Here, Bill Evans. almost like he's alone in the room with his piano, isn't it? With the instrument, just here. If at the end, this is entitled "Masonry in a Complex Era," sort of like pulling back, smiling, and just enjoying the view. If at the end of a given day we experience an approximation of the original thinking that was built into Freemasonry, I think it's because of the diligence of men bent over their work in the laboratory. Idea thieves. They borrow not to take credit due another, as middle managers and bureaucrats tend, but those flashes of ingenuity, compressions of ideas. The collective unconscious, what Jung described as unconscious mind and shared mental concepts. The corridors and rooms in our minds that feed a narrative not always understood. We have been asked to share the single most important volume of knowledge on Freemasonry and distribute it to literate confidants, knowing they would have their own valuations. They will succumb to yours for the sake of discussion and illustration. Together, the work is read and debated. If page by paragraph, by sentence, by word. And yet what comes out of the exercise is more than what went in. If we want to move through time, we pick up a book. It is artificial to think ideas spoken are standalone because continuity. There is no beginning, no end. We study snippets, knowing this. We refer to stereotypes, hoping for clarity, being a reminder that what we experience, what we know, is of continuum. It's not for geometry and philosophy to guide us. It too would seem chaotic instead of complex. As time wraps around us, we have particular characteristics to emulate. Joy of understanding is not the bliss of ignorance, is not fact. Happiness is more than a passing emotion. Do we even set our goal to surpass our complacency? Do we commit to the challenges and accept the dignity that our ways have been instilling for 700 years? Do we commit? Assuming we have cultivated a relationship with ritual and released the genie from this bottle, a lifetime is never going to be enough, and yet it will be more than ample to be the Mason that you can be. The challenge, the Herculean challenges that we face have to do with the way we digest this information. Is it true? Is it real? It can elevate those boys over there feeling that they have a sense of importance. And for a lot of men, that is tremendously important. But do we judge constantly? We're taught this through the delights, those little gems that are littered through ritual. My goodness, how can you not be amazed at it? Something that can talk to us about history and time and ethics, and then talk to us without blushing, talk to us about the impact of probability of the fates without joking about it. How can you? That's delightful. And can you imagine that I only want one answer? I'm going to ask the one question today, what is the effect of all of this on me? And whatever answer I come up with today, that's it. I'm not going to ask the question again. That's it. I have to move on. Except in the next hour, I'll ask the question again and move on from there. And it's lovely. It is a treat to think that I get to experience the curiosity of other people and a sharing of ideas. And an understanding or an awareness, is all of this juxtaposed? You know, I guess I'm succumbing to the idea of some of the current theories. Simulation theory, is it illusion? I go through, you know, and yet some of you, a long time ago, began writing about this, and you illustrated this so beautifully. You articulated these ideas so incredibly artistically. They're just lovely. Do I surrender to the will of ego, or am I looking at, if I look inward, then I get into the unconscious. Then I get into knowing the truth about ethics and values and what and how I go about my conducting myself. I'm not so clever. I don't declare with any vehemence these notions anymore, and yet I think it makes me feel curious when I see people that are irritated or angry as they're talking about these just incredibly delicious ideas. Why the anger? Why the irritation? Why the intensity? This is the way it is. This date, you're out by a microsecond. Where is that? I think that's lost energy myself. But where the hell is that coming from? Perhaps if we listen to a little Coltrane, it'll become clearer. Everything becomes clearer when you listen to Coltrane. And it takes us a step for closer toward... Thank you. John Coltrane, beautiful, beautiful interpretations. It never matters until it matters. It's not important until it's important. Life and the things going on around us. Let me talk to you a little bit about drawing on some of the best from our past. Why are we at all? Why are we curious, Masons? Why are we curious about poetry at all? Why? I've often wondered. I was talking to Andreas. Why is there an expectation that he for his advancement to write a poem and to present it? Serious. And yet, is that? I think that I don't have a chance to say. Well, I'm going to start here. We started from a clean slate, you know, where I am, and we built on. Well, I don't know that. I don't think I have much of a preoccupation with that anymore. There's some curiosities out of it, but. Does that shape what's going on? No, I don't think we're recognizable. What's going on? And as the dear man Joseph said, well, if Mozart walked into a lodge and sat down, what would his impressions be? Yeah, maybe it's an interesting perspective to take on and an interesting exercise. What would he recognize? Would he be upset by certain things? Would he be impressed by other things? It brings to the surface, asking a question like that brings to the surface these notions of self-loathing and doubt, all the things that personalities project. And we can say, well, this is all, you know, it's like, the notion of going to a hospital. How many old fools do you say? Well, if I go to a hospital, they're only going to tell me that I'm sick. So as long as I don't go near doctors or hospitals, I'm fine. See, it's complicated, isn't it? Do you want to know? Do you want the genetic testing that outlines profiles your entire life? Your proclivities. Can you handle that kind of truth, or can you live with that? And what does that do? Will it change you? Well, I'm pretty damn sure it ought to change you. But how to live with that? I don't know if they have instructions on the bottle for that kind of thing. Why would we be looking into the details? Because we do, and it seems that active minds find this. Curious minds find this deepening their understanding of the life and their place in it. And there's a fulfillment. It's like a sense of walking through something and noticing things that aren't evident at first glance. It's not to say it's not there, but if you don't notice it, it isn't. Is it there? If it's, you know, if it's information that would be in hindsight pivotal to your well-being, and you're not paying attention, is the information there? And how do you know? And what do you do? Well, I apply those kind of simple logics to the craft, the field that I've chosen to try and understand. For the accumulation, we need to, I think, realize we can benefit, and we do benefit tremendously from accumulated knowledge and history. We are, I'm drawing on the romantic poets, because the beast is the condition of people. And before that, it hadn't been articulated until 18th and 19th century. We're seeing, imagine, these notions were there, but in small measures. We didn't see, even the Victorian period, realism. It really is highlighted, a focus on what affects all of us, pessimism, the notion of that chafing around science and technology, and questioning God. Who are we? What made us theology students? Even our poetry began to demonstrate or reflect senses of responsibility and morality. And then we had this curiosity, these interests in medieval myths and folklore, this humor, and we began to develop monologues. And this is well after 14th century, 15th century stuff with Shakespeare and Marlowe and those, that crowd. What the poetry today that I picked comes from Alfred Lord Tennyson, and interesting fellow in some ways. And this, if you told me that you were the fourth of 12 children, I would think, when I was younger, I would have echoed what I had heard, the burden and the burden, that many children, that's very, very hard on women. And it's a struggle to live. It's a lot of mouths to feed, a lot of responsibility. And the just say no notion is always prevalent, because it makes us feel smug. Entitlement allows us to do that. Just say no. Nancy Reagan's ridiculousness. But here, this guy that we're talking about, I like that sense, Joseph Campbell's sense of the hero. You go through a journey, you overcome great difficulty to amount to something, to create some kind of goodness from or benefit. This is the guy. This is one of those guys. This wasn't the guy with a silver spoon. He was the fourth of 12 kids. Grandfather had violated a tradition by making his younger son Charles his heir and arranging for the poet's father to enter the ministry. That was what was done. You had one in the, if you had boys, one was the heir, one would go in the military, one would go into the priesthood. The contrast of his family, it's really put his family under great pressure. But he was fortunate in a way. There was wealth in the family, his aunt Elizabeth Russell and his uncle Charles Tennyson. They lived in castles. And that made Tennyson feel very, very poor and led him to worry about money all his life. I disagree with the author saying that he was worried about money. He'd be more worried about paying the bills, enough to eat, roof over the head. But it wasn't very his dad deteriorate. No magic there, eh? Men have been doing that. Fathers have been doing that. He became paranoid and abusive and violent. And to get away in 1827, this guy, Alfred, escaped and took off with followed his two older brothers to Trinity College, Cambridge. And he had a tutor, William Whewell. 19th century philosophy. Because they published poems by two brothers in 1827, and each won a university prize for poetry. Alfred won the Chancellor's Gold Medal in 1828 for his poem Timbuktu. But the Tennyson brothers became very well known at Cambridge. And in 1829, the Apostles, an undergrad club whose members remained Tennyson's friends all his life. And in 29, the Apostles invited him to join. The group met to discuss major philosophical and other issues, including Arthur Henry Hallam, James Spedding, Eddie Lushington, who later married Cecilia Tennyson. A lot of them became very famous men who merited entries in the Dictionary of National Biography. Like, these men became significant. And Hallam was perhaps the most important of these friendships. He was a precociously brilliant young Victorian man, like Robert Browning and John Stuart Mill and Matthew Arnold. Lofty company, him. These weren't fools. But Tennyson was always sensitive to criticism. So if that speaks to you, you're in good company. The mixed reception to his 1832 poems hurt him greatly. Critics of the days delighted in the harshness of their reviews. The Quarterly Review was known as Hang, Draw, and Quarterly. And his harsh criticisms of some of the poems in the anthology kept Tennyson from publishing for another 9 years. Ouch. But the success of his 1842 poems made Tennyson popular. And in 45, he received a civil list pension, £200 a year, which helped relieve his financial difficulties. He was only 41, written some of his greatest poetry, but he continued to write and to gain in popularity. And in 1853, he raised to the point where he could move into a new house in the Isle of Wight. Prince Albert dropped in. I don't know, just love the guy's poetry. We'll leave it. There's more. He's an interesting guy. Now the poem, the attention to the detail. Pour yourself a cup of whatever. This is a beautiful poem. This is the Locksley Hall. And it starts off that it's a poem about Tennyson becoming aware that he was falling in love with a woman who was beyond his station in life. They just, you know, that age-old problem. She's too good for me. She lives a whole different life. But anyway, here's what he wrote about that. Early one morning, a soldier asks his comrades to leave him at Locksley Hall, an estate near the sea. And in his youth, he spent many a night at the hall, gazing out a window at stars, and particularly those in the constellation Orion and in the Pleiades cluster. You might have done that yourself. During the day, he often wandered the beach while thinking of the promises of the future. My goodness. Clairvoyant, isn't it? And in the spring, this knight says, a young man's fancy turns lightly to thoughts of love. And so it was with him that he told his cousin Amy that all the current of my being sets to thee. And she told him, I have loved thee long. They spent many mornings in the moorland listening to the sounds of nature, and they passed many evenings by the sea watching the ships go by. And now she's out of his life, for she was a puppet to a father's threat and servile to a shrewish tongue. Parents, eh? So she lowered herself and married a man unworthy of her. And consequently, the speaker says, her husband's nature will have weight to drag thee down. He will treat her little better than his dog or his horse. And she will have to be there to humor him and his moods. But I had loved thee more than ever wife was loved, he says to the speaker. And the speaker berates Amy for forsaking him, saying she apparently never truly loved him. And the day will come when her husband will die, and will not before she has a child who will become the center of her attention. And when the child grows, she will lecture it with a horde of maxims, telling the child to be chary of her feelings, as Amy's own parents did, and such feelings could be dangerous. What is that which I should do? The speaker asks. The soldier dreams of going off in a far land in the Orient with no traders and no ships with European flags, and there he would wed a savage woman who would bear him dusky children, who could whistle back the parrot's call and leap the rainbows of the brooks. But he relents and says he does not really prefer a rude and barbarous life. He bids farewell to Locksley Hall, hoping that a thunderbolt will strike it down. Interesting spin, huh? Comrades, leave me here a little while. As yet, 'tis an early morn. Leave me here, and when you want me, sound upon the bugle horn. It is the place, and all round it, as of old, the curlews call, birds. Dreary gleams about the moorland flying over Locksley Hall. Locksley Hall in that distance overlooks the sandy tracks and the hollow ocean ridges roaring into cataracts. Many a night from yonder I've casemented, and here I went to rest. Did I look on great Orion sloping slowly to the west? Many a night I saw the Pleiades rising through the mellow shade, the glitter like a swarm of fireflies tangled in a silver braid. Here about the beach I wandered, nourishing a youth sublime with the fairy tales of science and long result of time. When the centuries behind me, like a fruitful land, reposed, when I clung to all the present from the promise that it closed, when I dipped into the future far as human eye could see, saw the vision of the world and all the wonder that when in the spring a livelier iris changes on the burnished dove, in the spring a young man's fancy turns to thoughts of love. And then her cheek was pale and thinner than should be one so young, and her eyes on all my motions with a mute observation hung. Interesting. It's like he's saying to her, you're going to miss this. And life could be so much better. Life like this, with this kind of love and commitment, transcends it all. It should transcend it all. And so should you, if you really meant it. Here, Betty Carter, Lover Man. Thank you. Could grab our attention today out of history. Sure. Need a palate cleanser before we wrap up today? History. Here this historian, Margaret Jacobs, is drawing on some evidence and records from Holland because of the clarity it compared to much more known than both this where masonry was putting down roots in the Netherlands than what was going on in Paris. You would think being closer. So she's telling us that in the day there was a feeling that masonry was violating the rules. There were gentlemen's agreements and traditions, just the way things were. And they weren't to be challenged. And here, these Masons were coming along. Only, it was a pretty high-level challenge that they were talking about. You know, congregating and having conversations about things that were not their place in life to talk about. But the evidence shows that with the references to Rotterdam Lodge around 1721, this is very, very early on, early days. When you think back, not necessarily in the 14th century to now, run of Masonic nature, you know, men leaning in on serious conversations that included an understanding of Renaissance, that period of the thinking of the Renaissance and the thinking of the Enlightenment. It allowed intelligent people to raise questions, intelligent questions. I mean, they were doing that. So here, this has caught my eye. This is very, very interesting. As the evidence now stands, we know more about the Rotterdam Lodge in 1721 than we do about one that supposedly existed in Paris around the same time, composed of English and Irish followers of the Stuart cause. The Paris Lodge, dating from 1725 or 1726, may be the first of a long line of French lodges where a Jacobite exiles became prominent. Mm-hmm. Indeed, the association of Jacobitism hangs above the earliest known French lodges, as does the contradictory association, that of sponsorship by the highest levels of official British and hence Whig representation in Paris. In particular, Lord Waldegrave, the ambassador to the in the 1730s. And in the 1730s and 40s, French Jacobite Freemasons were active on behalf of the Stuart Pretender, a fact that was known to the governments of both sides of the Channel. Obviously, there were reasons why Freemasons in Paris or elsewhere on the continent, particularly in these early years, might want to maintain a low profile. Finally, to contemplate the origins of continental Freemasonry even further and to illustrate the danger of relying on so-called official Masonic history, we have testimony from the next generation of British Masonic officers. The historian de Villeneuve introduced earlier in this chapter that there were lodges in Saxony in 1729 and in Russia in 1731. We can say with confidence only that enough evidence exists to suggest that by the 1730s, Masonic lodges were popping up all over Western Europe, often sponsored by official representatives of the British government or by their Jacobite opponents. Hanoverian Britons were especially active in the Low Countries. The Jacobites seemed more prominent in Catholic Europe, all carried with them British political culture and mores. And in the Low Countries, the earliest lodges tended to be pro-British or at least supportive of the Anglo-Austrian alliance. Fancy that. The Jacobites moved and did what they could to maintain links with one another and to find some degree of safety because they were being wildly persecuted. I want to flip forward today, and we'll do it in another program. I want to fast forward to what's going on in the Crimea and the Ukraine and with a despot, a little guy with a big gun. Maybe we can do some comparisons, or you can do some comparisons, and we'll come back to this. Life goes on. It doesn't stop. Huh? And that wraps up our show for today. Thank you for sitting in and indulging, letting me indulge my imagination and share some ideas with you. This isn't Freemasonry. This is just atmosphere. This is what happens when you get to. I wish that we could sit down and meet regularly and have these conversations. And I wish I could sit back and listen to what you have to say about things relevant. And I would tend to think that we would might not be speaking so frequently about poetry. This is private indulgence. And if you ever hear me tuning up opera here on the show, you'll know that I've completely just become bemused by my own sentimentality. I won't do that. No. I need the vitality of jazz as much as you do. But we are in interesting times, and I think what we're seeing, and if you don't mind the comment today, what are we seeing, Dale? You must have asked me that. What we're seeing is the consequence of earlier decisions and earlier choices. And what that tells us and what we make of it, that's completely on our shoulders and how we respond to that. I believe, and perhaps you can tell me if it sounds incredibly naive, that we're just where I am, we're just beginning to build because we're just beginning to understand. And I could be wrong. I know that there's some severe scholars around me that completely disagree, but they, I think, would generally allow me this comment that there's the future is where we're going to find the depth of masonry and where I am in the continent, in North America. And to get there, we have the benefit and need the support of the work and the excellence that's been going on for a long time from some remarkable places in Masonic history, from the continent, from Britain, from the scholarship that we see being supported, the enthusiasm coming out of the India, just so remarkably pleasing, really is. And the depth, this isn't just as above. There's a depth happening around us. Call it the occult if you must, if you're frantic and you're caught up in such things. But there's an enthusiasm for exploration, for depth, to take science and go a little bit beyond, to take myth and go a little bit beyond the arts. Anyway, before I wear out my boyish charm here again, commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. We'll tuck into topics that I think will be relevant. And in the face of so much conflict, remember your values, how to navigate through what's happening around and keep above it, keep above what's happening. It's curious. It's very, very curious mindset that masonry tries to cultivate. My goodness. I'll see you again soon, and thank you.